Welcome, welcome, curious souls, to the Macabre Emporium, your sanctuary for the unusual, the mysterious, and the appalling.
Step through our cryptic doorway into a world where secrets whisper and enigmas come to life.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah.
Together, we're your custodians of the macabre, guiding you through tales that defy the ordinary.
Discover the untold stories, from lesser-known cases of true crime to the bizarre events that captivate us.
Join us on a journey to the shadows where the mainstream fades and the extraordinary beckons.
So whether you seek the bizarre, the eerie, or the chillingly obscure,
you're in for a treat here at Macabre Emporium.
Welcome back to Macabre Emporium. This is episode 76.
And if you're fresh out of the vault in Appalachia, welcome! Because it's episode 76.
Oh, Jesus.
What? Come on.
You're such a dork.
I haven't got to make a Fallout reference, I don't think, in 2 years now, since we're not going to have an episode for our Potterversary.
Yeah.
Or maybe we might talk about it a little bit before, you know, next week's, the first episode of the Ween Month.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, 2 years. Can you guys believe it?
I cannot.
Nope. And all the weird, crazy stuff we've done. Things we never thought we would do together. This.
Things I never thought I'd do, period.
True. But we'll talk all about all that stuff next week.
Okay.
So anyhow, it's a Sarah-son this week.
Yay, me.
Yay, Sarah. And I already put the cover back on, so I can't do the applause and cheer for you.
That's okay. You can do it in real life.
Yay!
Without the button. There you go.
Okay. Anyhow, Legosi's clapping too, even though he's just loafing on the table.
Yep.
But anyway, what do you have for this week?
I have true crime that is eerily similar to another case that I've done.
So it's probably going to irritate the shit out of me by the time we're done.
No, I don't. I mean, it's irritating in general, but
right.
I don't think it's going to get you like others have gotten right. You.
But before we get that, we got our on this day for September 25th.
Yeah.
So on this day for September 25th. So for September 25th, 2024, on this day, journalist Barbara Walters was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1929. She was a news anchor on the Today Show, 2020, The View, and ABC TV. David Bowie released his 20th studio album, Outside, in 1995. The hit singles from this album were The Heart's Filthy Lesson, Strangers When We Meet, and Hello Space Boy, The Pet Shop Boy Remix. In 1959, The Mummy premiered in the UK, starring Christopher Lee as the Mummy and Peter Cushing as archaeologist John Banning. So we're going to test Sarah also here real quick. Who also played the Mummy in 1932, but would also be play a much better known Universal monster the year before, 1931.
Bela Lugosi?
No.
No?
Nope. Boris Karloff as the Frankenstein monster. Or just Frankenstein.
No, Bela Lugosi has played so many different things.
Right. But yeah, he's best known as Dracula.
Yeah.
Michael Campbell set the world land speed record at 146.16 miles per hour in 1924. He would set his final speed record in 1935 and be the first person to drive an automobile exceeding 300 miles per hour to Bonneville Salt Flats.
Hmm.
Billy the Kid would escape jail in Silver City, New Mexico by climbing out of a chimney and becoming a fugitive in 1875. And we all can boo this guy for this dumb idea, but Henry Ford announced the 40-hour work week in 1926.
Boo this man!
Boo! And not like a ghostly boo. All
right.
And American golfer Arnold Palmer dies of heart failure in 2016 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the age of 87. Besides having the iced tea and lemonade combination named after him, he also won the U.S. Masters Golf Tournament 4 times.
I was going to say, it's all that sweet tea.
All that sweet tea and lemonade. But yeah, that's our on this day. I know that was a little short, seemed a little shorter than normal.
It was all the categories that you hit.
Yeah.
So, tis all right.
All right.
It's cold as fucking.
Here. Yeah, well, it's that time to turn the heat on here in the Emporium yet, so.
No, it is not. And no, we will not.
Nope, not yet. But anyhow, are you ready to get started then?
I is.
All right, let's get going.
Jesse Blodgett was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1994 to Buck and Joy Blodgett. She was an only child.
All right.
They moved as a family unit to Hartford, Wisconsin, when she was still pretty young. She had many friends growing up and was generally just well-liked. She had an extremely close relationship with her parents. They had the kind of relationship where you could literally talk to them about anything and they could talk to her about anything.
Yeah.
And there was no topic off limits. So anything from relationships to drugs, sex, it just didn't matter. They'd talk about it and there were no judgment between any of them, which is kind of nice, I think.
Yeah, to be able to have those talks with your parents and not have to worry about it or sneak behind their backs and learn about that shit the hard way.
Yeah.
Because I remember it's like my freshman year in high school. You know how most parents are like, oh, that's got a parental advisory sticker on it. It's got cussing in it. You can't listen to it. And like, for example, for me, big in my area, don't know how big ICP was in your area.
Big, because they're from that area.
From Michigan, basically. But I remember growing up, one of the dads of the kids that I hung out with, he'd like listen to all that shit with it. And he was like, yeah, I just figured, you know, might as well listen to it with my kids because they're going to listen to it behind my back anyway. Because I made the comments like, I've never seen a parent so into ICP like you are. And that's what he told me when I said something about it.
That's fair. Shitty band, but that's
right.
Fair.
I mean, like all the rap stuff that was big at that time, like Eminem and Master P and Wu-Tang Clan and all those guys, you know.
Master P.
Right.
Yeah. So they were.
Can you name another Master P song besides make them go, you can't.
No, I can't.
All right, now that I got this off track here, I had to get it out. It's kind of like holding in a fart. I gotta say it. But anyway.
But yeah, as I was saying, just very open and honest with each other. The parents to her and then her to her parents. Buck and Joy took immense pride in the fact that Jesse was extremely talented in the arts. During high school, she was somewhat of like a local star because of her artistic abilities.
Yeah.
And she was super smart, so everybody knew her for being the smart kid. She starred in a whole bunch of school plays, often signing up for just about everything that she could. She sang in the choir. She was a good dancer. I didn't catch if she was on a dance team or anything. And she excelled in all of her classes, which I cannot say the same for me. Jesse took a stance on many topics that were near and dear to her. So she was an animal rights activist. She took up for domestic violence and social equality. Jesse had big aspirations for herself and her parents, and pretty much that whole town knew that she was going to do whatever she set her mind to. She had actually wanted to become a choir director when she graduated high school. Her main thing was that anything that she could do musically that would improve the life of somebody else or bring them joy in any aspect is what she wanted to do. After graduating high school, she went to the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee on a scholarship for music education. She was an extremely hard worker, so while she was going to school, she worked part-time in a restaurant. And on top of that, she had a side hustle where she was teaching piano lessons and giving singing lessons to kids in her home. So she was busy.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
While she was doing the lessons at home, she literally could have turned that into a full-time job because at the beginning of it, she had 26 kids that signed up. And I can't imagine that that's something you can just go in for like a half hour and do. It's right. Probably like an hour or more, I would think.
Yeah.
Jesse had a ton going for her. Everyone knew she was going to have a bright future. Her parents knew it. Like I said, the town probably knew it. I'm sure she knew it. Jesse had a best friend in high school by the name of Daniel Bartlett. They were inseparable, always sitting by each other in shared classes. He was also very artistically inclined. He played the violin, and he was first chair, and Jesse was second chair.
Okay.
So, very similar. Together, Jesse and Daniel would often be found somewhere playing music together. Just outside of class, whatever. If they were together, they were making music. Some kind of art. So you could pretty much say that he was like the yin to her yang.
Right.
Very similar people, similar life.
They were just like peas and carrots, as Forrest Gump would say.
I suppose. But yeah, academic levels, artistic levels, they were like neck and neck. Right. And I think that's why they got so close. This closeness did turn into something more, and they became an item. While they were both happy, Daniel decided to break up just before they started college. since he was going to another state and Jesse was staying in Wisconsin. They remained friends through all of that. Jesse found out through the grapevine in 2013 that Daniel had dropped out. She wasn't super concerned about it, even though he was a straight-A student. And when she talked to him, he basically kind of told her, like, you know, I went for as long as I could. It just wasn't my thing. Jesse did start to worry, though, as Daniel became somewhat depressed, just moody. And she had kind of chalked it up to him missing home and missing his friends at home. So when Daniel returned to Hartford from school, he had a long-term girlfriend at this point, and he was happy to be back and have Jesse back in his life and be able to reconnect with everybody back home. Daniel wound up confessing to Jesse that he was in love with her and not his girlfriend. Jesse was flattered, but told him she only wanted to be his friend at this point because she wasn't looking for anything.
Right. She's got too much going on as it is.
Correct. Jesse and Daniel recorded a song together not long after his return to Hartford, and they posted it on their YouTube channel, which gained a ton of local traction. Not long after that, they were both chosen to play lead roles in local plays. Jesse was chosen to play the role of the fiddler in Fiddler on the Roof. The opening night for that was July 14th, 2013. It was a packed house. At the end of it, like, her and the whole cast got standing ovations. Daniel was chosen to star in Bye Bye Birdie. On the night of July 14th, after the play was over and things wound down, it was time to celebrate. Jesse, her friends, her castmates, they all gathered up and went to a cast party. As much excitement as there was surrounding how well everyone did on opening night, for Jesse, it started that way, but didn't end that way. While she was at this party, there were two older guys that kept, like, hitting on her, making her extremely uncomfortable. So she didn't stay long. She wound up going home. She got home around 1 o'clock in the morning, in the early morning of July 15th. And her mom, Joy, was up. So Jesse sat down with her mom and she talked to her about, you know, what had happened. She stated that the two older guys at the party were hitting on her, making her feel uneasy. She then went to her room and wrote down what had transpired in her diary, clearly not wanting to forget any of the details of what had happened before she fell asleep. Buck was up really early to head to work. Joy was getting laundry around and dropped Jesse's off to her room before heading to work herself. But she made sure that Jesse was in there sleeping peacefully before she left, and she was. Joy had made it a habit to come home for lunch since she worked nearby. And she had made a mental note that it was really quiet inside the house when she got there, which was a little unexpected. She assumed Jesse was still passed out from the long day she had had prior, so she just kind of let her sleep.
Yeah.
12:30 p.m., there was a student due to arrive for a piano lesson, and the fact that Jesse wasn't awake yet,
starting to be concerning.
Yeah. So Joy went upstairs to wake Jesse up so that she was ready for her first lesson of the day. However, Joy was not prepared for what she was about to walk into. Jesse was still in bed, face down, and her skin was blue in color. She immediately called 911. I have a snippet of what was said in the 911 call. Mm-hmm. So 911 answered, and Joy was screaming out, "My daughter is blue. I went to wake her up. I just got home for lunch, and she won't wake up. Oh, my God." They asked if she was breathing. Joy said, "I don't think so. No." And then they asked, you know, "Do you know how to do CPR?" And Joy's screaming, "Jesse, she's so cold. She's cold." And they asked again, "She's cold?" And Joy said, "Yes, she's cold. Oh, my God." Joy touched her daughter and realized that her clothes were soaked, and so was her hair. When she rolled her over, she saw ligature marks around Jesse's neck. Thankfully, she wasn't in the house alone long because EMS showed up very quickly. They looked for signs of life. They didn't find any. 19-year-old Jesse was gone. Her dad had to be held back by first responders that were there. They wouldn't let him see her.
Yep, we've had to do that before.
He was distraught, and he just wanted to say goodbye to her before she left the house for the last time, but they wouldn't let him.
Right.
Hartford police found that Jesse had very red ligature marks on her neck as well as on her wrists. This immediately let them know that they were looking at a homicide and not natural causes or suicide. Now, I said Joy found her with wet hair and clothes, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so at this point, police think that it was done by whoever killed Jesse. They cleaned her body to get rid of any DNA before tucking her back into bed. Like, she was tucked into bed like she went to sleep on her own.
Yeah.
Under the covers. So police needed to know what happened, but above all, Buck and Joy needed to know what happened. With not much in the way of physical evidence on her body, other than the ligature marks, the police had to continue just looking and hoping they found something. Their first clue was Jesse's journal and her entry about the two guys from the night before. Further details came out that one of them was a coworker from the restaurant she had worked at, and the other one was an older guy that kept pulling her down, like, into his lap.
Suspect number one right there. Case solved.
The guy that kept grabbing her called into work the next morning. So that made him, you know, that was pretty suspicious.
Again, case solved. Boom. We're done. See ya. Bye.
Unfortunately for detectives, both of those guys had very strong alibis, and they were dismissed as people of interest. They did find a roll of tape, like duct tape.
Okay.
Which they thought could have been dropped by whoever did this. So they bagged it up and sent it off to forensics just to see if anything could be picked up off of it that didn't belong to Jesse herself.
Right.
Little did detectives know, their next clue was going to come from a neighboring city and an incident that was currently going on there. In Richfield, Wisconsin, there was a girl by the name of Melissa Etzler. They were looking for a person that was connected to an assault that happened to her. She was attacked 3 days before Jesse was killed. She had been out walking her dog, and a man with a large knife came up and tackled her from behind. She was face down in the dirt, fighting like hell. She was able to get the knife away from the guy, but cut her hand in the process of, that struggling. She wound up getting the knife and yelling at him to leave, and he basically asked her permission after being told to leave. Can I go? Can I go? And he got in his car and drove off.
Okay, that's bizarre.
But she said it was like a, what do you call it? Not fish scaling knife. A fillet knife.
Okay.
Yeah. Melissa was able to get a really good look at her attacker, though, because obviously he stopped long enough to ask permission to leave. Right. So she described him as being a white male, 6'2", blonde hair, like 210-ish pounds, 18 to 20 years old. She said he had on plaid shorts, a hat, sunglasses, and that he was driving a blue Dodge Caravan. Melissa had no idea that she was going to be the catalyst that helped police find Jesse's killer. Police had seen that exact van in a field in Richmond about a month prior to Melissa's attack. Just because it was, a small town, so people had, like, particular spots that they parked in that the police knew just from patrolling.
Right.
This wasn't a vehicle they had ever seen.
Yeah.
So they had taken the plate down, didn't run it or anything, but just kind of like,
who the hell's in our town? I mean, we're even like that, you know, looking out the shop, the Emporium windows here, yeah. Anybody pulls in, they're like, who the fuck is this?
Yeah. Once they found out about this, this attack, they did run the plates, and it was registered to Daniel Bartlett's parents, you know, Jesse's ex and best friend.
Yeah.
A couple of days after Jesse was killed, Richfield police called Daniel in for questioning. At this time, Daniel was at Jesse's vigil.
Yeah.
Jesse's parents had assured him he'd be okay and that friends were always brought in for questioning and he'd be fine. Jesse's parents were the ones that said that. Just as a side note, absolutely nobody knew about this attack on Melissa except for the detectives and Daniel.
Right.
Nobody else knew. When Daniel got to the Richfield police station, he was escorted into an interrogation room and they asked what happened to Jesse since he had just said he came from her vigil.
Right.
He straight up blurted out, I think someone raped and murdered her.
Oh, that's interesting. How did you come to that conclusion so fast, guy?
It was an immediate red flag to the detectives. One, because, well, the biggest, the only one, Jesse's autopsy results had not been released to anybody, including her parents. They didn't even know the actual cause of death yet.
Right.
But how did Daniel have an idea of what happened?
How did you come up with this conclusion when, like, nobody knows what's going on other than, you know, was involved. And also, like you just said, autopsy results haven't been released to anyone yet. But how do you know, guy?
The entire interrogation was recorded as Mostar. Daniel was under the assumption that this was about Jesse, but it wasn't. It was about Melissa the whole time. They were just asking, like, you know, what happened to your friend?
Yeah.
When asked where Daniel was when Melissa was attacked, Daniel gave an alibi of being with his girlfriend. The officer asking questions noticed a cut on his thumb and scrapes all over his arms. Daniel had said that he got those cuts at work, and the cut on his thumb was from being punctured by a nail. He wasn't a smart man. Investigators were already way ahead of him. They knew he hadn't been working because he was no longer employed.
Right.
They knew he lied to his parents about it by pretending to get up and go to work every morning when he wasn't working. Investigators then honed in on that cut on his thumb and kept poking and prodding about how did you really get that cut?
Right, because even you take a nail, do you know how much pressure you have to use to even get a nail to quote unquote cut? But still,
he said, oh, it punctured me. But this was a full on gash in his thumb.
Punctures are a hole.
Right.
We're talking about a laceration.
I did say he's fucking not a smart man.
Dipshit.
He tried to lie again and told them that he cut his thumb while he was chopping vegetables for dinner. They called his bluff, and then Daniel finally admitted to being the one that attacked Melissa. His excuse was that he was trying to scare someone. But why would he want to scare someone? Well, he said since quitting college, he was scared of everything in life and wanted someone else to feel scared too.
Fucking dipshit.
Yeah. Daniel's fingerprints and blood were found on the knife throughout the park, as well as on that roll of duct tape, just like the one that was found under Jesse's bed.
Right.
Thankfully, Melissa was not harmed. She's alive and well and was able to point his ass out in a lineup.
Good.
And that's all obviously. It took for an arrest, huh?
That's good, obviously, but...
And that's all it took for an arrest. Daniel was arrested there on the spot and transported to the Washington County Jail. Detectives kind of stewed on the fact that he straight up said that Jesse was raped and murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And since what happened to her wasn't public information as of yet.
Right.
You're like, okay, we're going to look into this a little bit.
Right. Because, you know, I mean, from other shows we listened to before we started ours, you know, how many killers, you know, kind of gave themselves away mm-hmm. for that or, you know, taunted law enforcement by giving away details that, you know, in letters that only them and the killer would know.
Yeah. On July 17th, the autopsy results were 100% complete and released to the public. It was determined that her cause of death was murder via strangulation, but it also showed that 19-year-old Jesse had been raped, which is what Daniel told the detectives literally the very day before this. Hartford police went and talked to Daniel again. He insisted that he didn't know Jesse was dead.
Bro, they got you on video.
Even though...
And you just came from the vigil before you were interrogated.
Right. Even though he told the Richfield police that he had just come from a vigil. He said he lied to his parents the day Jesse was murdered by saying he was going to work and he left at 6:30 in the morning. He stated he went to Woodland Union Park instead. Investigators then went there and searched through trash bags. In those bags, they found alcohol wipes, more duct tape, a homemade ball gag, bloody paper towels, and climbing ropes, which matched the ligature marks on Jesse's neck, wrist, and ankles. That rope, there was also more of it in Jesse's garage.
And you said a climbing rope?
Yeah.
That shit's not cheap either. It's super fucking strong.
Yeah. The most damning evidence that they found was his DNA underneath Jesse's nails. And his sperm inside of her. Daniel's computer was also searched. They found searches of strangulation, bondage, and serial killers, which I don't think if anybody searched our history that it would be a real, real great bunch of searches either.
Speaking of that, you know, weekends I keep to myself, but I watch some of our friends on Twitch and, they were playing some game called Lockdown Protocol, which one of the things is like you can use C4, and somebody searched like was about to search that. And they're like, no, don't search that. You're going to get the FBI at your door. And so I put in the comment sections like, really? What do you guys think my search history looks like? And nobody's come to my door yet. You guys will be fine.
It's bad. They also found a book that he was writing called Red is Red. Once reading that over, they found that the premise of the book was about a girl named Jessica who was bludgeoned to death by a character simply known as D.
Fucking Annie. Oh, my God. Wow. Anyhow.
Daniel's closet held the pair of plaid shorts that he was wearing when he attacked Melissa, still covered in blood. In those shorts were pieces of tape that had human hair stuck to them, which was determined to be Jesse's. This was all the evidence they needed. They had the DNA. They had the clothing. Melissa had the weapon. She right. kept that shit from when he attacked her.
Right.
So, yeah. While in court, Daniel said that he did all of this to quench his sexual urges and that Jesse was a very easy target because of how close they were.
Which is sad that that's kind of the deal because of them growing up and being so close. Mm-hmm. But also, he looked up all these killers and he didn't put the one thing together that got a lot of them caught was you don't keep shit. But anyway,
I said, not a smart man.
I know you did, but still, he clearly proved that.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to look up Ramirez and fucking Kemper and Gacy and all these guys. And what was the one thing that a lot of them all got caught with? Because they didn't kept shit. They kept fucking trophies and all that, you know?
Yep. Daniel was charged with first degree intentional homicide in regard to Jesse. He pled not guilty, but it only took a jury 3 hours to find him completely guilty.
Like 3 hours too fucking long.
Right. I could have walked in and said, guilty, slammed my hand on the table, and that would have been it. He was also charged with reckless endangerment and false imprisonment in regards to Melissa. Daniel was ultimately sentenced to life in prison without chance of parole. Not once did he admit to what he did to Jesse, even though the proof was literally there.
Yeah.
He never apologized to Melissa for what he did to her either. After his guilty verdict, Daniel put out a statement to Jesse's parents, her grieving parents, that said, I can't tell you the reasons you're looking for. There's no hiding from yourself in a tiny concrete cell. This jumpsuit that I'm wearing, these shackles don't make me guilty. I know there's evidence that I can't refute that makes you believe that I'm guilty. Absolutely no remorse for what he did. None.
Right.
He just kept maintaining his innocence.
Right.
No sadness for what happened to his high school sweetheart. Just emotionless self-preservation. He didn't apologize to them.
Yeah, it's kind of like Ronald Clark O'Brien, like all the way up to the end. Like, even with that guy, it's like, dude, the needle's in your fucking arm at this point.
Yeah. Buck Blodgett, Jesse's dad, had a statement of his own for Daniel. He said, I forgive you as I have every single day since we found out it was you. I believe there's good and bad in every one of us, so I don't demonize or vilify you. Gotta say, that dude's much kinder than I would have been.
Right. It's also like kind of like the one dad we saw a couple weekends ago on the court cam TV.
Yeah. Locked me in a room for 1 minute.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Larry Nassar, that piece of shit. Yeah. It's like, can I get 5 minutes alone in a room with him?
So Buck actually went on to start a nonprofit in Jesse's memory called the Love is Greater Than Hate Project. And the mission of this project was to end violence against women and most of all, have everyone choose love over hate, which Jesse would have absolutely loved because she was an activist, you know, for women, you know.
All things women, basically.
Sorry.
Since you're spacing out, can't remember.
Yes. Thank you. Daniel. Sorry. Prisoner number 006-21440 is still incarcerated at the Waupun Correctional Institution in Madison, Wisconsin, where he will hopefully die. Well, he'll die in there, but hopefully sooner than later.
Right.
Fucking Wisconsinites.
Except for one of them. Two of them, technically.
Two of them. Yeah.
Two of them that we know of for sure.
Right.
And all the other ones that we don't know of that listen.
That aren't this asshole.
Right. Everybody in Wisconsin except for this dipshit.
Just this one. This one asshole.
All right. So what is the other case that I'm just trying to think of while you're telling me this, that this is very similar to, that I cannot remember?
Georgia Williams.
Okay.
You know, the one who was asked to pose on a box with her.
Right.
With a noose around her neck.
Right. And then the dipshit kicked the box out from under.
Right. Because of them being very close, and then him writing a book basically about her and what he had planned to do to her.
But why was she found soaking wet, though? Because
what police assume, because they don't know for sure, is that because he raped her, that he tried to wash his DNA off of her.
Yeah.
And then he put her back in bed.
I didn't think of it that way. I was thinking of it was, like, he tried to fucking drowning her. I didn't think to put two and two together. She's soaking wet because he tried to clean her body off.
Yeah. So that's they don't know for sure, but that's their guess. That's
what they're, you know, what they're thinking was strong confidence, I think it is the term.
Yes. But that's my case this week.
All right. But yeah, I got nothing else about to say about this one other than this guy is fucking stupid.
Yeah.
Like I already said in this, it's like you looked up all these guys and you didn't realize they all got caught. We're leaving evidence behind. Well, other than Richard Ramirez, like I mentioned, he got caught by an angry fucking mob, basically.
Yeah.
But the rest of them all got caught by doing stupid little things, you know, like Kemper, broken taillight, you know, but that's it. Nothing else.
I got nothing.
But hey, next week, we're going to be back with October. The Ween will be here finally.
The Ween.
Yay. So, got anything particular that you want, you already got in mind just for October?
I don't. I need to look into some things.
There is a true crime case that comes up next month that we have the opportunity to do of on the anniversary, in my wheelhouse, basically.
Yeah. Well, don't say nothing.
I'm not gonna say now. But I already talked to you this about before, so we might have to swap some weeks around, maybe.
I don't know.
We'll have to see how that works out.
Yep.
But on that note, I think it's time we close the Emporium up for the day, Sarah. What do you think?
I agree.
So until next time,
remember to creep it real and don't be as stupid as Daniel.
Right. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye. Join our Facebook group by searching Macabre Emporium. Like and subscribe on YouTube at Macabre Emporium Podcast. Follow us on TikTok at Macabre Emporium Pod. Follow us on Twitter at Macabre Emporium. If you have any stories of the paranormal, your local true crime, or weird history that you would like us to look into and possibly do an episode on, email us at macabreemporiumpod@gmail.com. And remember to follow, rate, review, and share whenever and wherever you can to help us grow our podcast.